Okay, so in my former life in Muncie, before Klal Yisrael became unfortunate, for better or for worse, before Klal Yisrael had to deal with issues which we'd really rather not deal with, meaning we wish it wouldn't be necessary to deal with it. So my son had a Rebbe that's every parent's dream of what a Rebbe should be, and his name was Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz. And a Rebbe par excellence, a pedagogue, an amazing Rebbe, an amazing person. He went on to found the yeshiva, Darkei Noam in Muncie, and he went on to make workbooks and aids for learning. And I believe Rabbi Yaakov sort of brought to the fore the Inyan of Children at Risk, with like a one article blew open the whole parsha and the Jewish Observer, I believe it was. Jewish Observer, all of us, Shalom. Yeah. And, but then he, he then stood up in the forefront of a problem in Klal Yisrael that's not easy to deal with, not very, we all know, right? We all know. We all read the papers. Chas v'shalom, he's going to be talking about that today. But, and I'm sure, I haven't followed his career, really, but I'm sure he's met opposition in his approach to things. I asked him tonight specifically, after talking a little about the Shemirah, that specifically I asked the teenagers, sometimes think they don't need to be taught that, but to focus most of the talk on something we all want to know. We're all clueless. I include myself in that. What do we let our kids do? What don't we let them do? How do you set gvulos? How do you stop them? We're not here. We're not banning everything, right? That's not who we are. And if I always get into trouble when I talk. So what do we do? So Rabbi Yaakov Shlita, please educate us.
Hi, everyone. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. I've spoken in this neighborhood a few times. The last time was a little, it was during the Gaza thing, and I like spoke like three words, and then a siren went off, and I said, I'm used to having responses to controversial things, but this is a little, you know. So we're going to talk about child safety as it relates to teenagers. And I really want the talk to be, I wouldn't say fun, but I want you to laugh a lot. Because if you're raising teenagers, you have to laugh a lot. So we're going to talk about raising adolescents. I really would like to frame it about in a discussion about a broader discussion of what adolescence is, why teenagers do stuff that they do, and how to help them navigate through technology. The phrase that I often use to present this idea of, you know, this whole technology thing, I call it postpone, protect, prepare. That's my motto. It sticks in my head. Postpone, protect, prepare. Meaning, you postpone as long as you can, and there are so many variables, and we're going to talk about them. As long as you possibly can, you know, every day that you keep your kids away from the challenges of technology, they'll be a day older when they deal with it. It's a good thing to do as long as you can. Protect means while they're starting to get used to technology or while they're using it, see to it that you have filters and supervision and a discussion about internet use. But I think the first two is what we often spend our time about, you know, postpone and protect. Ultimately, if we don't prepare them to make good choices when we're not there, I think we've long-term failed. And that's much, much more challenging, and it really requires a whole different thinking about parenting, and I look forward to discussing it with you. So let me talk to you about child safety. I'm going to go through the general, the four messages of child safety, why it works, and then specifically as it relates to adolescents. One of the great challenges of speaking to adolescents is that adolescents are indestructible and they're going to live forever. So, and there's no danger. You know, I'll never forget, there was Nebuchadnezzar terrible. I was a camp director two lifetimes ago, even before I had Rabbi Milanowitz's son. And there was Nebuchadnezzar, a terrible tragedy. A few boys died in a crash. This was a very long time ago, mid-80s. And when I heard about it, I immediately went to the office, and I rented a bus for the Levaya that my Talmidim, my counselors in camp, I was a camp director at the time, I didn't want my counselors renting cars and driving into the funeral after somebody Nebuchadnezzar got killed on the highway. And sure enough, I announced that I went into the kitchen, I told the guy to make sandwiches for everyone, and I rented a bus. And by the time I got out, 10 minutes later, like, they were all planning, and, you know, like, they're indestructible. That's the way it is. So it's a challenge, but it's doable. Look at the seatbelt law, at least in America. I don't know how it is here, but it was the most, if you think that it can't be done, why are you laughing? Right. Oh, they don't do seatbelts here. Well, I think that they've been extraordinarily effective with the campaign to get seatbelts over the last 30 years. When I started driving, nobody wore them. They had these ding-dongs that came. People tied the belt behind their back. They knotted it. You know, everybody had all these crazy ideas. But the kids today, by and large, do it. They've been educated. It was spoken about. And there were restrictions. You can't drive the car. So I think things are doable. They need to education. So the basic notion behind child safety is to teach your children of any age that they should be aware and knowledgeable. I mean, the four messages are no secrets from parents, to teach your children that no one is ever allowed to tell them to keep a secret from you. It's extraordinarily inappropriate. Nobody should ever tell that to your child. And it's a huge red flag. Okay, your body belongs to you. This is much more negative for little children, but to teach the kids that they have a right to defend their personal space. That's something that they own. Good touching, bad touching. Some places are appropriate to touch, some aren't. Like, you know, with a younger child, you would say a spot covered by a bathing suit. The fourth one is extraordinarily relevant to teenagers. That's the most challenging part to teach, and probably the most important. And it is basically you're teaching the children to follow their instincts. That means what you're saying, the words you use is, no one has the right to make you feel uncomfortable. And if you're in an uncomfortable situation, get out and I will support you no matter who it is. And this is really, really important. I think the first three, you know, they're not really the gay ups. Teenagers keep secrets from parents anyway, right? You know, the fourth rule is really important because that really prevents grooming. And grooming is a process. Thank you very much. Who did this? What? Who put it out? I just want to say thank you.
I had it done, but the person who did it is different.
Thank you to both of you. So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes. You know, I usually do this in an hour, but we have another topic, but Rabbi Milanowitz correctly, I think it is a point. It's stuff that's not spoken about with adolescents. So understand this. It's very, very rare, less than 5%, the different results on different studies, but less than 5% of abuse comes, you know, a one-off. Somebody comes off the street, a stranger danger, you know, weirdo in a raincoat. You know, it's very rare, extremely rare. Usually it's people the kids know. And usually the predators, in a very evil way and in a very brilliant way, go through a process which we call grooming. And grooming means groom to prepare, not like to groom, you know, like that. What? You know, I say, you know, to groom means to, like, you're grooming somebody to take over your job, to prepare. And what they do is, what they do is they basically want to find out if this child is safe, so to speak. Can they get away with abusing this child? And I've unfortunately met so many predators over my lifetime, especially, you know, the last 13 years, and they're brilliant at this in a very evil way. And the basic idea, I give an example. I'll leave the example out, just in the interest of time. The basic idea is they want to find out if your children have been spoken to. And the way they do that is they'll, for example, see if they have a curfew or there's a time. Do they have to call their parents if there's a change in the schedule? If you're doing some, if you want to look up an article that is fantastic, Malcolm Gladwell wrote a piece called In Plain View. Write it down. If you're interested in looking it up and printing it, I would strongly, strongly encourage every parent to read it. It's called In Plain View. And he explains how Jerry Sandusky at Penn State got away with molesting kids for 30 years. And what they do is, you know, he discusses a coach there that used to tell the kids, he would actually, a coach that was put away for many years, not Sandusky, but he describes the technique, and the technique was this guy had, he was a soccer coach, he had 10 kids on his team, or 20, whatever it was, and he would say, guys, practice is going really well. You know what? Let's play for another 20 minutes. And a few kids would raise their hand and they'd say, just a minute, I got to text my mom. If I'm ever more than 10 minutes late, I got to text my mom. And this evil guy says to himself, okay, not you, and not you, and not you. And then he would do things, tachpulas, you know, ideas. You got to be a. He would steal sports equipment from the kids, drive it to their house, and give it to the mom. Hey, Joey left this at practice. So how did Joey like last Sunday's game? Says, oh, he never talks to me. Bang. That's someone I can molest. And if she repeats the entire, you got to read this article. I really encourage you. It's called In Plain View. I've read hundreds, many hundreds of articles and stuff. To me, that is the plain speak. It's really, you got to get your hands around this idea. Once you understand it, you really can prepare your kids. So that's the idea. Literally, they take 20 kids and try to figure out. Now, another thing that they do over time is they invade their space slowly. Like they'll, for example, pat him on the back, touch him on the shoulder, him or her, by the way. It's not just guys, and it's not just the predators aren't only men. But what they'll do is they'll slowly invade their space, and they want what they're looking for is a reaction. If a child was spoken to, they'll give him that kind of look, and he knows, okay, not this one. So the point is, what you're really teaching the kids is, because there's a grooming process, they feel uncomfortable, generally speaking, way before anything happened. And the problem is that when they come and tell you things, you don't really understand what they're saying because you might not understand the context. They might not be able to verbalize what they're feeling. They could say something like, the guy sat down right next to me. Now, you're all sitting next to each other here. Nobody's feeling weird because the room is full, right? Imagine if there were two people in the women's section and, you know, somebody sat down like right next to you. It was the only chair and you didn't know this person. You'd start really getting nervous. So how would you explain that to somebody? You might say, well, the room was empty and there's nobody there, and this person came and sat right next to me, and it bugged me out because I felt uncomfortable. Or you might say, I don't know, just, it's a feeling. You can't even explain it. So what you encourage your children that if they're uncomfortable, get out, and you will support them. And you can't see, you know, you never know how attuned children's radar is. Those are basically the safety messages. I think it's important to have discussions with your adolescent kids. Usually, I will talk about it later, best discussions usually happen when you don't say, sit down, there's something I want to talk to you about. That's like a good, if you want to pick a good fight with your kid, that's usually a good way to start. Is that, sit down, there's something I want to talk to you about. How long is this going to take? How dare you? What's on? And then you're, whoa. Okay? So it usually happens when it happens. So, you know, think about it that way and just have a talk with them about protecting this space and that you're supporting them. And another extraordinarily important message to say in this abuse space and abuse prevention and anything else is to explain to the kids that no matter what they tell you, you're fine with it. You'd rather know. That's what it sounds like, folks. You say, Shefalo, Yitzi, Rifki, whatever it is, I would rather know. If there's something going on in your life, I would rather know and be upset than not know about it. Just imagine how uncomfortable it is to talk about something that happened to them that's really, you know, that really bugs them out. You know, statistically, you would say 2 out of 100 kids would do this. How many kids would come home and talk if Chas v'Shalom something really happened or they got in a bad spot? You know, we'd be really uncomfortable. Even if it was, you know, if it wasn't chalila, full abuse. So that's the message you want to give your kids. I think it's also very important, and this is especially for girls, but really all kids, it's very important to teach them that safety rules apply to everyone, including guys like me. Meaning, explain that it could be a mora, it could be a principal, it could be a Rosh Hashiva, it could be a Rav, it could be a really wonderful person in the community that everybody loves and respects. The rules, when we hear of these scandals that take place, there was usually really bizarre behavior and total boundary breakdown way before this. And people are kind of wrote it off. This person, they're just quirky. You know, that's the way they work with kids. They're just, you know, is that Jerry Sandusky, the quote that he writes in the article that Malcolm Gladwell writes, that's just Jerry being Jerry. And what he did is this fascinating research. People, predators sometimes groom communities. Think about it. When I saw it, look at that. Your face is exactly that, you know, that shudder. I read it. I said, oh my goodness, what an astounding idea. I just saw it a couple of years ago. I've been in this pasture for a long time. So grooming communities mean they do things that are a little quirky or they operate differently than other people and they have a different set of rules, for example, with as far as boundaries go. So it's really important, especially girls, to teach them that if it's a friend of one of their brothers that's coming over, an uncle, whomever it is, rules apply across the board. It's really, really important that you get this notion across. And I think, you know, one last thing on this, and let's get on to our topic. I suggest that we need to think differently about what supervision means, what it means to watch your kids. Now, my wife and I raised our kids in a very different generation. We were clueless. I'll give you an example. We had a family that stayed with us. It was 28 years ago. It was before I had a nice dad. I had a nice quiet life. Nobody, you know, no phones were ringing. And I look at it now and I say, Hashem was just kind to us. There was a guy came to Muncie. His kid, he lived in Midwest town. His kid was Megayer. He had a Bekesher by the time he was 16. It was like the weirdest thing. And the father came who wasn't even Jewish. It was a whole Zach. And one of the guys in town, he said, all right, who can we put like a really odd thing? Oh, Horowitz. Great. So he calls me up. And he asked us if we would, and we hosted them for 2 months. And we had 4 young kids. If any of my kids did this, we would have a long talk. Whatever. Hashem was kind to us that nothing happened, but anything could. So think about your Shabbos guests. Think of people rolling in and out of your house. Think of how relatives interact with your children. You know, I didn't think like this. I do now, but I didn't when we were raising our children, but we know stuff now. And we stopped, you know, we got the rose-colored glasses off, and we know that we're not exempt from the world's problems. It doesn't mean that we're worse than any other place. It just means that we're not, you know, we would think that if somebody keeps shermatar mitzvahs, like, how could he even get down there? But it's a sickness. It's not an avera. It's a sickness. And you don't know who has it. So really talk to your kids. Don't frighten them. The research shows that if you frighten kids when you talk to them, they really don't remember what you said. There's a stunning research. If you have a safety book, we did it in a way that's, you know, fun to turn the pages. And so that's the way. Have the conversation like you would with a child about crossing the street or touching the fire. It's important. It's a little, you know, something to be concerned about. But it's not a 10. Because when it gets past, you know, 5, 6 in terms of anxiety level, they shut down. Okay? Hopefully we'll have some time for Q&A. If we do, I'll take stuff on this also. But I just want to get through our presentation. So we need to talk about teenagers. How many of you have kids over the age of 8? Hands up, please. Just about everyone. Okay, how many have over 13? I just want to get a sense. Okay, this neighborhood's been around for a while. Okay, how many, so that's it. Okay, so you basically all have teenagers. How many have All kids out of the house already. Hands up. Can we go party? So the good news is that you survive. And the good news is that you can learn techniques as to how to, you know, raise adolescent kids. Basically, get a sense of humor. Really, I really mean this. Get a sense of humor. Learn to roll with the, just ride the waves and just, you know, don't take yourself so seriously. If you really have a house, which I think is extremely important, to have the type of home that kids want to hang out in, which to me probably is my number one goal as a parent. I tell parents the number one goal is just to try to create a home where the kids want to hang out in. Because if it's not like that, if there's stress or there's other stuff going on and the kids don't want to be home, you're really not kind of parenting them because they're everywhere else. So that's a really, and if you do that, that's very expensive, folks. Rabbi Yisrael, it's very expensive. That does not come cheap. If you want to have a house that kids want to hang out in, you're going to lose your cleanliness, you're going to lose your privacy, you're going to lose a lot of money, you're going to lose everything. It's basically like just coming and going. But always think of what the other side looks like. What does it look like if they don't want to be home? That's what you got to ask yourself. What's plan B? Whenever you talk about technology or any other activity, should I allow my kids to go here? So it's not a binary, it's not yes or no. It's what happens if not. I'll tell you an adorable story. My wife and I, our children, Kanahara, range in age from 35 to 21, Kanahara, and four out of the house. I'm not yet up to partying with you couple of guys here, but, you know, we'll get this one. And our kids, the first four were born within 6 years of each other, the boys first, then girls, two boys, two girls. So girls become teenagers before boys, so it was basically all four of them at the same time, and I promise you, I don't know how we survived. But our oldest always had an affinity for cooking, and he was always into that stuff. He's a great cook. So we were walking up the steps. I'll never forget it. We were walking up the steps. He was 17, 18. He had just learned how to drive, and my wife is, I've never been accused of being neat and orderly. You know, I'd like to think I have some good qualities, but nobody's ever accused me of that. And, you know, most people marry opposites, by the way. That's part of, I have a theory on that. I'll get to it in a minute. I think it's, we marry opposites to work on our own midos. One reason, it's just you learn to, you know, when you're single, you can do anything you want. You don't like your chavrusa, same. You don't like your roommate, go, change somebody else. Now you're in a relationship with someone whose generally personality profile exactly the opposite or really quite opposite of yours. I think it's designed by Hashem. Another reason is because it helps you get things done. Someone needs to make the trains run on time at home, right? So someone needs to balance the checkbook or not balance the checkbook. You know, so we have different skills. I think Chazal say, I'd like to humbly suggest a different pshat than Rashi. It's Rashi says, Ezer Kenegda. You marry an Ezer Kenegda. Ezer is a helper. Kenegda is opposite you. If you were describing, Hashem told Adam, I'm giving you an Ezer Kenegda. So you should say Ezer Etzloi, right? Etzloi means next to you. When you're going on Kenegda, means you're opposing. So Rashi says it's either an Ezer, if the guy doesn't daven, well, he gets a Kenegda. I don't know, why is it the guy's fault? Whatever. We'll get to that some other time. But I'd like to suggest that perhaps you could say that an Ezer is a Kenegda. Every one of the department heads I ever hired in my yeshiva, or any person in administrative level, in tragic guess, always had the exact opposite personality than I did. Because I have one of me. Now I need somebody else to do the other stuff. So anyway, it's part of Hashem's sense of humor, or the way the world works, is that we wind up. So my wife is extraordinarily organized. You know, we're going away for Pesach, Matzah Purim, you know, as soon as Shalach Manos goes away, suitcases get open. Anyway, you got to get the picture. I'm walking up the steps, 11 o'clock, 11:30, really late at night. It was winter time, so Shabbos was over 5-6 hours. And my wife is one step in front of me. We're going up to bed. Good night, kids. And, well, by the way, good night, kids. Just stay up, right, you know. So we're walking up the steps, and my oldest tells my wife, says, Ma, is it okay? I found a great recipe for pasta sauce. And my wife started to, like, cook with convulsions, like, you know, getting pictures. Kitchen was spotless. And she says, you know, I saw her take a breath and say, like, any great answer, like, why now? What's wrong with 8 o'clock? Remember, I'm going to clean up my, you know what that means, right? The pot is in the same zip code as the sink, right? So, you know, so any one of those answers would have been, why now? Why are you doing this? You couldn't figure out, why does it have to be Matzah Shabbos? And then I went up behind her. I whispered in her. I said, Udi, if you say no, he's going to ask for the car keys. And then she went like. So this is how you got to think, folks. It's not, can I do this? And it's not saying whatever smart things we think of all the time. You don't have an unlimited reservoir of things to tell kids. One of the practical, non-therapeutic, non-research-based, just an idea that I had, excuse me, for parents, I would really encourage you to think about doing some variation of this. If you find yourself being very critical, and you find yourself getting into arguments with teenagers, just all raise your hand together. You know, if you find this happening often, what I found to be a helpful exercise is take a few cards or post-its, number them 1 to 3, 1 to 5, 1 to 10, pick a number, whatever you like. And this one child that you're having difficulty with, or all of them if you do, let's say you do 1 to 10. So what it looks like is after Havdalah, this Matzah Shabbos, you take 10 post-its, you put it in your pocket, or put it a place where it's accessible, and every time you criticize the child, you lose one. And you don't get any more till the next week, till the next Matzah Shabbos. Okay? So it's right after Havdalah, and your kid, stand up straight, why are you walking like that? Oh, oops, 9 to go, I made it 10 minutes. And then you start thinking, is this worth making a fuss about? And that's a great road to really trying to improve things with adolescents, is realize that that number, whatever, you have 10 with a 6-year-old, you have 3 with a teenager, and Mirtz Hashem, you'll have married children. Those of you who don't yet, Mirtz Hashem, Hashem should bench you all with married kids. You'll learn that you have one card every 2 years. I'm not joking, folks. You want it? What? You don't even have that. Thank you. There we go. Spoke the wisdom of experience. So, again, I think this is all part of Hashem's plan to make us better people. You learn to really bite that lip very hard when you see stuff, or you just go for it. So let's get started on discussing adolescence, and then I want to back into the technology thing. And I said, I'm letting you know in advance, this is, the Rav said he always gets into trouble when he speaks. I don't get into trouble, but I speak my mind. So let me offer you a different way of thinking of things. Why did Hashem give us free choice? Here's a couple of questions. No summer camp runs on free choice. No shul runs on free choice. You can't just decide where you want to park yourself. They don't make, zmanim, unless it's a real shtibel, but there's times and there's places, there's rules that you got to follow. Hashem made no rules. He told us what to do, but they're not enforced. Not in this world, not that we see. We could do anything we want and nothing happens right away. Notice we don't get zapped. Hashem gave us full free choice. Think about it. I was talking to the parent of a teenager about a year ago, and he was talking about what the kids are doing. And so I spoke about this thing of Bechir Chav. She says, I got to tell you, if I was on the board when they were making these rules, I wouldn't vote for that. Think about it. Why did Hashem do this? Another question. Why is it that exactly adolescents, 13 to 20, 12 to 20 for girls, the halacha is that if they damage another human being, they have to pay. If they scratch somebody's car, break a window, destroy something, they have to pay for the damages. But they're part of b'dinei shemayim. So if they commit a sin only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with no human involved, they're part of it. It's really very... What's the logic behind this? So, the Rav said that we're not banning things, right? Why do bans not work? They just have never worked since the beginning of time. So let me tell you what I think. We learn most of our lessons from our mistakes. That's the way it is. People give you advice. You nod your head. You really kind of want to listen. And you learn to put a raincoat on because you got wet once, not because your mother told you to. And you learn that this is what happens. This is the way the world is. The most enduring lessons. A lot of kids that have drinking problems, some of them don't stop and really have a big problem with it. But a lot of them, it's not the people telling them, which you should do, not to be drinking, but they get roaring drunk and get violently sick and have a hangover for 2 days. That's better than all the lessons that you give them. That's the way it is. So I believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us free choice so that we should have the ability to stumble around and find ourselves and learn the lessons we need to learn to become better people. And I think that's why it's set up, as far as I said about a spouse and having adolescent children for us. You learn patience, you have to learn tolerance, you learn humility. Let me tell you something, folks. You look at some very stubborn, obstinate people. I hope not, but they usually have at least one teenager that just brings them to their knees. So all of this, I think, is part of Hashem's design. I think Hashem gave teenagers this time period to make their mistakes from 13 to 20. So that's why Hashem, I can't let you destroy people's property, you'll destroy the whole world. So you can't break people's windows, you'll pay for it. If you can't, you don't have money, we'll sell you as a slave and you work it off. So you'll have to learn to treat other people with respect. But Hashem says, I get it. I'm giving you a waiver until you're mature enough. Because they're not mature enough to do all this life. So therefore, I think that in that last thing that I spoke to you about preparing your children, part of this thinking is to have the type of relationship where your kids can really talk to you when they make mistakes, supervise them, but walk them through their mistakes. What happens when Bechira Chafshis is taken away completely from children, they become teenagers when they're 22. That's what you see. They can't manage this Bechira, and then the stakes are so much higher. Okay? So adolescence is the period where children transition from your home to a very uncertain future. And for those of you who made Aliyah or moved to a different neighborhood or changed jobs or anything, there's a lot of anxiety with change. People always wonder, why are teenagers moody? Why are they so irritable? And why are they, if you pick words for teenagers, like, you know, go ahead. Want to try it? Teenagers are obnoxious, crazy. Go ahead. What else? Challenging. Teenagers are cranky. What'd you say? Cranky. Teenagers are
unpredictable.
Good. What teenagers are? What'd you say? Impulsive. Can somebody say like one nice thing? Teenagers are fun. Idealistic. Okay, that's enough. Interesting. Thank you. Yeah, I know that. When my Rebbe used to say, Yankee, you're really being interesting. I know what that meant. and you said, one of the women said idealistic, which one of the funniest things about teenagers is they're idealistic. They'll volunteer to go to a camp and work with disabled kids, and you can't get them to pick up a fork at home. You know? It's not just that they're idealistic. They're idealistic and selfish at the same time. It's so confusing. You know why, folks? You know, Rabbi, I keep saying folks, Rabbi Sai. The reason they act like they're confused is because they are confused. It's a very confusing time. It's a time of transition. All transition is stressful. Okay? If I want to ask somebody for a donation for Project Yes, and I meet a friend of mine at the airport, a good time would not be when his shoes are in his hand, you know, walking through security. That is not a good time to approach someone, right? Or you pull up at a hotel and you're trying to get a bellhop on a Friday afternoon, and, you know, that's not a good time to talk to people. Teenagers are like that all the time. And it's much more frightening. Put yourself in a teenager's shoes. Kid's 15 years old, and you ask him some questions. Okay, where are you going to live? Are you going to marry? Will you be popular? Will you have parnasa? Will you, you know, will you be a living? Every single one of them, I don't know. So when you switch to, you make aliyah, and you know where you're going to, and it's stressful. For one thing, if you go on a plane ride, it's stressful, and you know it's over in 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. So that's what happens with teenagers. And we also, they don't really know who the boss is. Who's the boss of a 6-year-old? It's very clear. Who's the boss of a 22-year-old who's living at home? the 22-year-old? Who's the boss of a 15-year-old? I don't know. Depends. When my wife and I, and we started the yeshiva, we ran it ourselves for like 8 years. We did everything. Then I started hiring department heads. So I've learned from my mistakes, and there are many, to ask professionals. So I asked someone, you think it's a good idea? My wife is my right hand and my best friend, and I, my confidant, I can talk much smarter than I am. So I asked this person if my wife should continue working in the school when the department heads are there. So I hired a Hebrew principal and an English principal and a business manager, everything that we did together. And I said, okay, where does my wife fit in here? She said, I'm happy. Just leave me alone. I'm out of here. I said, no, I can't let you go. You have to help me. So he said something so smart. I asked a few people, and one of them said something so smart. He said, you know, it's very confusing to the staff, because when they talk to her, are they talking to the boss's wife or are they talking to an office manager? So a principal outranks an office manager, but he doesn't outrank Yankee's wife. So if my wife goes over and says, you know, let's say a principal comes over to my wife and says, you know, here, Mrs. Horowitz, could you please make these 25 copies? So if she's an office manager, she says, sure. And if she's the boss's wife, she says, yeah, I'm kind of busy right now. So how does that work? Could you get somebody else, maybe get one of the secretaries? I'm tied up with something. So he said it is, and, you know, I've observed it from the outside. I did take his advice. She stayed in, but it was very clear that she was, you know, she was my helper. But that's what's confusing about teenagers. We don't really it's a work in progress. If you ask, like, how do you make decisions at home? Yeah, well, you know, kind of working it out. So let me talk to you about some advice and what to understand, what to do this. So you try to really build your relationship with them. You try to spend time with them. It's so hard. If you have young kids only, if your oldest is 9 or 6, I just beg you, spend time with them. You know, there's no tamura, there's no exchange for that. You can't buy it, you can't sell it, you just have to do it. And it's hard, it's really hard. There are obligations that we have to other children, we have obligations to our parents, we have obligations to our friends, to our spouses, to the kahila. And people say nice things to you when you do things for others. But, you know, nobody's going to throw a parade for you or honor you at a dinner for reading a kid a bedtime story. So it's much more glamorous to do the other stuff. So if your kids are young, it's one of the ironies of life that the kids, you know, when they're young and they're begging for your attention, we don't get it. And then they get older, and the teenager, you'll do anything to have 10 minutes with them where they're really listening to you. So really try to get in the habit of spending time with the children, and try to just understand adolescence, this period in their life where they're going and they're going to the next level in their life, and it's your job really to kind of get them there, to support them and get them to the next phase. I'm going to do some, we'll talk about some of these things during question and answer. Now I want to talk about technology. Okay? Postpone, protect, prepare. So let's answer this question. How old does a child have to be to get on the internet and the parents will never know? Six or seven? Three? Four. Oh, let's put it this way. Let's word it a little bit differently. How old does a child have to be to get into trouble on the internet? Okay, that's maybe a different way of wording it. So it's not just like going online to play, you know, whatever it is, or flip your phone. How old does a child have to be to get into trouble using technology and their parents will never know? 10, intentionally, yeah. Or even by mistake. By mistake, they could do it at 2. Right, but I'm talking about, you know, kids going on and saying, my parents aren't looking, let me do whatever. It's not 18. Do we all agree? Okay, it's not 18. Right, whatever. It's not 18, and it's not 15. And it's probably not 12. So when Al Gore first invented the internet, That was a joke. when the internet first started again and you had those squeaky, phone lines in the jam, you know what I'm talking about, right? So when you had those squeaky little lines, parents were much more in control because you pulled that line out and the kid didn't have to connect the internet. There was no Wi-Fi. The cities were hot. They didn't have 4G everywhere, whatever else they got. Now, it's a whole different ballgame. I still have a record. I have a videotape. He said the Jewish Observer. I spoke at an Agudah convention in 1998. There was a panel, the three of us, about talking about teens at risk and stuff. And the two people before me were both speaking about technology. And so you've got to keep the internet away from kids. The whole speech was only about technology. And I got up to this. I said, it's an open book. So I got up and I took a credit card out of my pocket and I said, I don't know how they're going to do it, but sometime in our lifetime, there's going to be something like this that the kids are going to be able to go into a drugstore and buy like a phone card. And what are you going to do then? If all you're doing is taking it away from them, what are you going to do when you can't supervise them? So when I say postpone, I mean just postpone as long as possible with all these variables and till the point where they're going to do it behind your back. And they will do it behind your back if everything is no. It will depend on the age. It depends on the temperament of the child. It depends on what neighborhood you live in. It depends on what your friends are doing. I advise parents when, one of the most common things you hear from kids is, yeah, everybody has it. I've actually encouraged some. I heard it from one community that I was speaking in that the mothers actually did it. They made a WhatsApp group of the class. All the class mothers were on the same thing, and they discussed when they're going to give certain stuff to the kids. And they did it together voluntarily. They said, how are we going to make this work? So every kid comes home and says he's the only one in the class or she that doesn't have whatever it is. So they communicated. I'm like, hey, did you? And they were able to. So the point where they're going to do it behind your back is the point where you need to think about starting to get to the next step where you let them have it with supervision. The rule of thumb is kids really would like to follow the rules that you make. But if it's just not manageable from their point of view, they're going to do it behind your back. One of my friends got, we wouldn't say kicked out today. He was, my day they said kicked out. He was temporarily positionally challenged from ninth grade because he got busted doing something. Actually, a few of us did something and he got busted. And, it was his turn. I took my turn, but that was his turn. So he went to the Rashiva called him into the office and he said, why'd you do, this and this and that? He didn't exactly express it right. I would have given him a little guidance at the, he says, look, Rosh Yeshiva, one thing I found about this place is it's an awful lot easier to ask for mechila than to get rishus. I thought that was a good line. The Rosh Yeshiva didn't, all right? So he got 2 weeks to whatever. So, but that's what happens at home, folks. If they can't get rishus, they're going to be asking you mechila when you catch them. So understand your child's temperament. Take the following, just think of this. What's their nature? Are they a rule follower or a rule breaker? Anybody here in Five Towns or Far Rockaway? Anybody know my brother, Rabbi Yehuda Horowitz? Anybody? You taught him, didn't you? No, I'm sorry. Anybody know my brother? Where do you know my brother from? Far Rockaway. You want to tell everybody what he's like? What? Okay. My brother is a malach. I have a brother 2 years younger than me that is an absolute tzaddik. I really mean it. I mean, you need a bracha, he's the guy to go to. He's really a tzaddik. He never said a word of Lashon Hara. We broomed together. He was like an A+, Aleph+, student, every teacher's dream. And he was normal with it. He wasn't like, he was a good athlete. He was always like this. He's a mashgiach in yeshiva. The kids, they call him the Holy One. He's in a modern Orthodox high school. They literally call him the Holy One. No one ever called me that in my whole life. Okay? I was always restless and out of the box. We were born in the same home, same set of circumstances. And that's just the way he was. He sees a rule, he says, great, Baruch Hashem, I know what to do. I see a rule, I say, how can I get around this? If you have a kid like me in your house, that kid's on the internet at 6. You have a kid like my brother, you're good till you're 15. You just say, don't use it. Okay. So you got to know your children. And it's not your, it's nothing, it might not have anything to do with how, what you two parents are like. So you really need that. You really need to know your kids. And, you know, think it, you could do it, think, if you want to figure out what your kid's doing, if you haven't yet, just, you know, think about the following scenarios. They, you walk out, think of an adult or, like, you walk out of the airport and there's a taxi line. There's like 75 people online. So most people, where's the taxi line here? Okay. You know, they go to the back of the line. And you get guys like me, like, forget it. No way. You go upstairs to departures. You jump in the back of a car. You know, you figure out a way to get around this. And it's a great skill to have when things go wrong. When things go right, it's a big problem. But when things go wrong, it's good to have someone like that. If you have a child like that, don't wait until it's too late. So you want to sit down, learn. So the first thing is postpone. Again, as long as you can, depending on your neighborhood, depending on the child, depending on your home, depending on your temperament. And then you go to the protect phase where you really have a talk with the kids. You explain the challenges to them, not in a, you know, Musa Shmuz way, but talk about the real challenges and you introduce it to them slowly. And for that, I recommend to people that you might want to do this as a shul project or a community project, to have someone really explain what's going on, what the apps are and what the kids are using, and it changes every few days. How many of you think the kids know more about technology than you do? Your teenage kids, hands up. Oh, my goodness. Okay, we got, by the way, less men raising their hands. They're not honest anyway. but you know, so think about it. Think about this job description. This is really frightening. Think about this job description. I have a job to supervise somebody who knows much more about the thing I'm supervising than I do. That's a little problem, folks. That is a big problem. So if you're at our stage in life and your kids are out of the house, you have every right to be clueless. And it's also, that's a great one, when you start doing this, oh, nobody talks anymore. Everybody texting, schmexting. Well, how come you don't? How many of you say that? Hands up, come on, let's go, there you go. Why don't you talk to me? You're never going to have friendship. She does it a lot? Yeah, big time. You're the king, the queen of it, right. So let me tell you what happens when you say stuff like this. Did any of you have like a great aunt that you loved, like who saved 400 paper bags? You know what I'm talking about, right? No, you really, yeah, I sure did. Now, you love them to death, but you're not asking them for advice. Okay, so when you say things like this, what's the matter? I remember back in the day, you know, when online meant you were on the grocery. Facebook, I'm a friend, you know, like. Your kids say, oh, my goodness, what a dinosaur. And that's what they think. They think you're not someone. They're not going to ask you for advice. It's as simple as that. So, like, don't advertise that you don't know what's going on. And don't say things that basically say, generation gap. So you don't want to push that forward. But I really encourage you to learn technology. I do a workshop now. It's called Parents Who Get It. That's the title. It's an hour and a half workshop. Parents Who Get It. Rabbi Milinowitz picked the topic. I'm fine with it. But it's a different, whole different idea. The idea is basically getting yourself to a position where you get it. And I have this great story, true story. I was at an Aguda convention. I spoke at the Aguda Rabbanim in 1999. At the time, in 1998, I actually wrote it up in an article. It's called Human Problems, if you're interested. It was a Mishpacha magazine. I wrote three articles in a row about child abuse in 2007, and the Rav was saying about not everybody is always on the same page. Like, it kind of got very interesting responses. Anyway, so I went to the Meitzes in 1998, and I said that I found out from the kids that they were selling drugs at certain phone booths in Bar Park and Flatbush. And the kids had a whole system. I heard this from the kids, and I went to check it out. The system was, you went to a phone booth. Remember those? Oh, that's a good one. I'm the great aunt. There you go. You want a paper bag? I got 40 cans of tuna fish. Anybody? Okay. And you know, like, there's certain things that you got to do to get that thing. Take Yahrzeit Lecht out of glass, melt down the, you know, like, come on, folks. How many? Melt down the, take the wax out of it, and now you got a matching set. Okay. So the thing was, here was the deal. They had certain phone booths designated, and the kids would walk over to the phone, and they would, like, go pick up the phone, and this is really what it looked like. If they put their hands in this pocket, it meant they wanted pot. The back pocket, they wanted ecstasy. They had a whole system, and then they put up numbers of what they wanted, so they didn't have to spend time making the transaction. And then they would walk away to a different designated spot, and they would do the deal in a second. They didn't have to count out anything, get three bags, give them whatever it is, boom. So I went to the Rosh Yeshiva. I wrote this in the Mishpacha article. Notice I don't write in Mishpacha anymore. Just a coincidence. So what happened was, I asked the Rosh Yeshiva, my great Rebbe, Rav Pam Zatzal was there. Rav Asher was still alive. And I said, I have this information. I checked it out. It's real. Do I go to the police? And my Rebbe spoke first. He says, is there any right for him? He said, they're out from that they're potential murderers, and you have to go to the police. So I went to the police. I said, there's probably a 40, 50-year-old running this. These kids are mules. They're just, doing the shlichas, so to speak. They're selling it, but there's somebody. It turned out it was the headlines in all the New York tabloids for weeks. There was a 50-year-old guy running it out of the basement to one of the shuls in Borough Park. Anyway, so I spoke about this at it was Rav Asher, Rabbi Bloom, I think it was Rav Asher still. He asked me to come speak about this to the Rabbanim. That's a nice task for a 35-year-old kid. No, I'm sorry? You asked me to speak up. Thank you. No, I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Please let me know. Wave your hands if I'm not coming out clearly. Thank you very much. So I was asked to speak about this to the Agudah Rabbanim. So get the picture. There's like 80, 90 Rabbanim in a room, several members of the Mieses Gedaliah Tarda, and this little 35-year-old whatever comes marching in to tell them all about drugs. So I did what I was asked to do. And I'll never forget it. One of the Rosh Yeshiva came over to me. You wouldn't put the two together if I told you who it was. A very distinguished, button-down, very Haredi, tremendous Talmud Chacham Rosh Yeshiva, came to me and asked me, he said, Rabbi Yaakov, do I have a drug problem in my yeshiva? Do I have to worry about a drug problem? I didn't know his school. He knew I didn't know his school. But do I have to worry about it? Good to kasha, Rev, huh? So I said, absolutely yes. So he said, you're telling me, he didn't have a yeshiva for his kids. It was a regular mainstream, high-achieving school. So he said, Rav Yaakov, let me understand this. You're telling me that the boys, the Bachram that I learned Ktzais with, and Rav Akiva Eger, and are sitting and steiging, I have to worry they have a drug problem? So I said, when I was a kid, I was a very, very wild kid. I got into all kinds of trouble. I didn't know anybody who drank. I didn't know anybody who smoked. I didn't know anybody I knew some kids who smoked, but I didn't know a single person who was using drugs, not a single one. There were probably 3 degrees of separation between me and a guy using. I said, every one of your bachrim is 1 degree of separation from a user. So that's something you need to worry about. So he said, what should I do? So I said it. Rosh Yeshiva, if you're asking me, it's kind of hard to say this to somebody, twice your age. I said, Rosh Yeshiva, I would recommend that the Rosh Yeshiva have an African-American sergeant in the 70th precinct who was my Rebbe on drugs. I'll send him to Rosh Yeshiva's office and he'll show the Rosh Yeshiva what drugs look like. How are you going to do anything about it if you don't know what a drug looks like? Right? I said, if somebody came up to you with Shiva with an ecstasy pill and he said, Rebbe, this will cure your headache. Like, how are you going to know that does Rosh Yeshiva know what marijuana smells like? Oh, there's such a sweet air, the Ruach HaTorah, it's beautiful. So I said, Rosh Yeshiva has to, if you got to know. I didn't know anything about this when I started Project Yes. I went to the precinct that they have offices. Ta-da, he had a whole case. And he gave me a shear on what it looks like. I told Rosh Yeshiva, I said, the kids come in and they go, I caught a cold. The kid's doing lines of coke, so you have to be able to know the difference. So I was so impressed. He said, send them up, set up an appointment. So I kind of backtracked a little. I said, Rosh Yeshiva, the yeshiva doesn't really have to do this. Just two rabbeim in the yeshiva have to do this. Not everybody does. Somebody in the building needs to know what's going on. So he said, you're right to have two perfect people, but I'm sitting in on the meeting. I don't want them to think that they're doing messy work that I wouldn't do myself. And I set it up, and it was just like that. That's how you got to think, folks. That's how you have to think. It's good for the Rosh Yeshiva. It's good for you. That means knowing and understanding technology and knowing what's going on is an evolving process. But if you don't know, it's almost impossible to really guide them properly because you're not speaking intelligently about a subject that's so important today. There are so many challenges that we don't even think about, you know, besides for the obvious, you know, the inappropriate stuff. But it's bullying. It's friends that they pick up. It's the fact that the one of the worst things that we don't even think about like that in our day before technology was, you know, made it. He really, look, there were challenges all along. The difference is the Yetzer Hara makes house calls. That's how you got to think of it. There was always the Yetzer Hara. Kids wanted to get into trouble. They didn't need the, you know, the Haskala came in Europe and we lost way higher percentage of kids to Yiddishkeit than we're losing today. And they didn't need technology to do it. They came by horse and buggy. So it's not, it's just that they make house calls. It's right in my pocket now. It's available. So, you know, learn it. So one of the greatest challenges is in my day, when a kid got into trouble, it was a very gradual process. And they got exposed to inappropriate things very gradually. Today, it's like, boom, literally 10 seconds. So learn it and understand it. Let me talk to you about prepare. And then I'm going to take questions. So there's a fascinating machlokes between the Rambam and the Ravid about Hilchos Tshuva, in Hilchos Tshuva. The Rambam asks, if you're interested, I wrote a piece in Mishpacha also. It's called Rambam or Ravid. If you just do Yaakov Horowitz, Rambam or Ravid, it'll come up. And the Rambam poses the following in Hilchos Tshuva. The whole idea of Schar V'Einish, of reward and punishment, is predicated on the notion that we have free choice, which I spoke about earlier. So the Rambam asks the question, how could you have free choice and believe that Hashem knows what you're going to do? Right? Hashem knows the past, present, and future. You have free choice. How does that work? So the Rambam asks this question in Hilchos Tshuva. I encourage you, those of you, you know, who have capacity to do so, I really encourage you to look it up inside because it's fascinating. You just see so much about them. You learn so much about their personalities and it so fits the Rambam's worldview and the way he, you know, he interacted with things. So the Rambam asks the question, and in today's vernacular, you would say he punted. He didn't answer the question. He says, basically, you know, listen, we can't understand Hashem's world. That's basically what he says. It's Aruch mi'eretz midu, Aruch ha'v mi'yom. He quotes some psukim, lo machshav ha'isem machshav ha'isechem. I can't think like you. We have to accept the fact that we can't understand everything about Hashem. That's basically what he says. So the Ravid, I'm not going to repeat the language. It's very strong language. He says, what in the world was Rebbe thinking? Why did he ask a question if he didn't have an answer? He should have left it to tmimus. He should have left it to sincerity. Why should he fill our heads with all kinds of questions if he didn't have a perfect answer for it? Why are you messing things up? So the Kesef Mishnah, years later, says, of course Rebbe asked this question. Any thinking person is going to ask this question. Let them know that the Rambam struggled with it and was still a religious Jew. That's what he says, basically, that his emuna was intact, despite the fact that he had things that he didn't answer. So I wrote Rambam and Ravid. These are two approaches to being mechanach your children. The Ravid says, don't talk about stuff. You know, don't bring up things that are going to ask questions that might not fit into a perfect box. And the Rambam says, look, they're going to be exposed to these questions. Let's talk about it. And I propose to you that because of technology, I don't think the Ravid idea works anymore. In those days, when the Rambam and Ravid were having things out, they had to go to a library. Today, I told this to my Rebbeim 10, 12 years ago. I said, everything you're teaching your children is going to be subject to review. You teach the Parsha of Noach. I said, don't stress the Medrashim that have these. Just be very moderate in what you present. Because sooner or later, the kids are going to get it could be at 18, it could be at 12, it could be at 35 or 50. They'll get an email from somebody saying, hey, did the Mabul really happen? So everything we're teaching our children is, that's what I meant about Rambam and Ravid. And it really goes to the nature of allowing your children to have discussions with you. And that's really the prepare part. The prepare part is about relationships. It's about having your children not do things behind your back. It's very hard because what you need to do in order to have them talk to you is to make a set of house rules that we don't punish you for things that you tell us. You can tell me anything you want. I want to know, even if it's going to upset us. Think of the reasons why kids wouldn't talk to their parents. Why would a child, let's say a kid started smoking or stole something in a store, why would that boy or girl not tell their parents? Go ahead. They don't want to be punished. They don't want to disappoint them. They're embarrassed. We got three. Go ahead. They don't want a speech. Good. Their parents don't get it. Right? So we have five different things here. One of the cutest answers I ever got to that, I did a survey with kids many years ago. I did a survey with teenage boys. I asked them, I took 95 kids, like one summertime, like high-achieving, best bachurim in Lakewood, like all the way across to kids who were not religious anymore from homes. And I asked them a lot of questions. It was just a two-pager. You know, it wasn't one of these scientific studies that I got a grant for. It was just Yankee in a pen, you know. But one of the things I asked them was, who do you go to? Who do you turn to when you need advice? This is what I wrote. You did something wrong. To whom do you turn for guidance? Anybody want to guess? Answer number one was? Friends was number two. Answer number one was? What? Very good. Head of the class. Answer number one was nobody. 40% of the kids wrote nobody. Parents got 10%. Friends, nobody. Friends, an older bachur, a mentor, a rebbe, and then parents. And when I asked the kids, why wouldn't you talk to your parents? They said exactly these things. I don't want a speech. I don't want to, you know, I'm going to get that look. They're going to look at me like I'm a cockroach, you know. And one kid was adorable. He says, Rebbe, I thought of the great aunt thing when he said it. He said, Rebbe, I promise you, just like this, my mother is such a nice, tmimistic lady. And whenever she sees me do things that she doesn't like, she doesn't criticize me. She doesn't yell at me. She doesn't punish me. She goes like this. And takes out a tillum. He says, she's a nice lady. What should I bother her for? She's really nice. Rebbe, you'd really respect her. He's telling me. He's convincing me. So, you know, every one of those is a barrier. You want your kids to talk to you. You want to be able to guide them through this craziness of technology in this changing world. They got to talk to you. So think of it. If you do 4 out of 5, they're still not going to talk to you. You got to remove every single barrier, and it's very hard, but it's doable. So you think about it. Don't embarrass them when they tell you. Tell them it's part of life, you know, and I'm here to help you, Shaykh Allah. And you say, you know, you don't punish them for things that they're going to tell you. And you say things like, I mentioned earlier, if there's something going on in your life, if you're struggling with something, I'd like to be part of it. I'll get upset. It's okay. But I would much rather know. That's what parents are here for. I hope you'll do this for my grandkids. This is part of life. This is called living life. I asked Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky. He's been a paisik for 20 years. A 17-year-old bachur came home from yeshiva. A top kid. Top. I mean, best bachur in Lakewood. Really was. He's off the, no, don't get the shidduch resume. He's spoken for. So he came home and told his father, you know, Ta, I really don't believe a word they're teaching me in yeshiva. He said, and this kid was, the father told me that he's a great kid and he's a great learner and he had some questions in Emunah. You know, I don't really believe there's a God. And the father calls me and says, help, what should I say? I said, help, I'll ask Rav Shmuel, 1 second. So I told him like this. I said, listen, I gotta go upstairs for this one. So I said, but in the meantime, before I get back to you, I want to tell you that you're an amazing, amazing father. Because I say less than 5% of kids would be comfortable talking to their parents just like that. Especially their fathers. That's something that kids would usually tell their mothers. And they wouldn't express it the way they did. They would say, you know, I'm having trouble with one part of the Rishonim, the way they explain one halacha. I'm starting to think that maybe there might be a possibility that epis something's not, that's not, they're not going to just come out and say it. I said, you're a great father. Pat yourself on the back. Anyway, I asked Rav Shmuel, whenever I ask, you know, for advice, or I always write down possible answers. like, and think to myself, like, how off am I? So I, it's a good thing to do, by the way. You ask questions. You want to know when you can stop asking, when the same things come up. You see, like, if you start, the gap starts to narrow, you know you're on the right path. Hasn't happened with me yet, but I'm a work in progress. You know, but, so I asked Rav Shmuel. I was so curious. I wrote like 6 different answers that I was anticipating and said he didn't do any of them. He mamish blew me away. It's just like Rav Shmuel in his simplicity and tmimus. I said, what should this father tell his kid? He said, the father should tell his son that David HaMelech says, Yimeish Naseinu Behem Shivim Shana, that we're here on this world for 70 years. What's he telling us? Just, chronological, how long we live, how to plan your life insurance. He's telling us, he didn't say that. No, but he said what he's telling us is that we have 70 years to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to understand his Torah throughout this fog of gullus and confusion and hester panim that Hashem's Shechina is hidden from us. So you have 70 years. Tell your son you have 53 years to go. I thought it was, tell your son that you have 53 years to go. If you say you don't believe what they're teaching you, so you have 53 more years to figure it out. And then, he should go. I told him, take him to a Kirov guy. Most Rabbeim are not really qualified to ask a lot of these questions because they don't do this. So it's that type of relationship, I think, that's so important to be able to have guide your kids through it. One practical thing I would encourage you to do, it's, again, this is just one guy, but what I found the best under these circumstances, it always becomes like a full-blown, when the kids want something and you don't want it. And by the way, if most of the class or most of the friends have a certain technology item and they don't, it's really, you're not in a good place, because they go to school and everybody's talking about the latest whatever, and they're saying, doesn't put them in a good frame of mind. So I'll tell you what I found to be very helpful. Take an index card, take a piece of paper, and tell your child like this. This is what I found. Again, I found this to be best. You write down 3 reasons, 5 reasons, what your concerns are, and give it to your child and say, okay, figure out solutions for each of these, and you got it. It's the essence of simplicity. In other words, you want to role play? You're my 13-year-old. Go ahead. What do you say? Ta? Yeah, but say like a teenager. I want a phone. Go ahead. Come on.
I want a Samsung Galaxy 7.
Yeah, whatever it's called. Oh, great. That's great. Whatever it's called. I don't know. What's with this dire? It's an iPhone. And that's another thing that drives the kids crazy. Whatever. Anyway, so, good. You want a new Samsung Galaxy? Like, you think money grows on trees? Like, so then you start getting angry. And you say, why not? Well, excuse me. It's not that important. Nobody cares what... It's really important is what's in your core. And by the way, this is a good message, but not right then. So I say, listen. You see, I have these 4 concerns. I'm concerned that you're going to go to inappropriate sites. I'm concerned that your schoolwork is going to lag. I'm concerned that you might get bullied online. And I'm concerned that whatever it is. I got 3. Here, figure out a solution, feature them, and you got it. You got it within 6 months or whatever. Demonstrate that. So you have to figure out a solution. I made you the jailer, not me. So you say, okay, you worried that I'm going to be on inappropriate sites? You can put any software on my computer, on my phone. You worried that I'm not going to do homework? I'll tell you what, when I come home from school, I'll drop off the phone with mom, and when I finish my homework, I get it back. I'm worried that I'm going to spend 3 hours a day? I'll do it an hour. We got to write it up, sign it, both of you, put some consequences there, and you got yourself a deal. The research, this is what I found to be most helpful, because you're really explaining it to the children. You're giving them a chance to hear what you're saying. The rules, they made the rules. How can they fight? Am I going to fight with themselves? Did that make sense to you? So I just think, so it's the Samsung 712, whatever, episode W. So this is what I found to be the most helpful intervention. Yes?
I have a question about that.
Listen, The question was, you know, what if you already said no, or what if you have a different philosophy? Listen, I'm one guy and I'm leaving tonight. You don't have to listen to me. And I'm going to make it clear. I'm telling you from my perspective, I'm dealing primarily with American children, so it's a big difference. That's what I meant. Pick your time. And if your time is, in other words, if your community, Kenei Nahara, is able to postpone the time to a much later place than the average family in Muncie, Kalakavod, that's great. So that's the variable. So that's the variable thing. That's what you talk about. That's exactly what I meant. There are variables, and you work within those variables to be able to not say no all the time, because that's going to get having them go behind your back. So, for example, if you have a child that goes to a different school than the other kids, and those kids are more exposed to technology, it's not my decision to make. You sit down as a family, you sit down with your Rav, you talk it over. Maybe you need to change what you're doing, maybe you don't. But I'm saying these are the broad goals. It's not, you know, my friend, Rav Fishman Zatzal, he was in Manal of Yeshiva in Cleveland and in Detroit, which is a tremendous machanach. He went to the Stifler Zatzal many, many years ago. And he asked them about setting a syllabus, learning-wise, for his yeshiva. And the Stipler told him, I wrote it down, and I actually put it in an article that I wrote. So Stipler told him like this. He says, first of all, I don't know American children. I know Israeli kids. So I can't really answer you. He said, and I only deal with Bachram and Yungalite. I don't deal with little kids. So find a wise person in America that you respect, and go to him, because I can't. I thought it was just brilliant. And then the third thing he said, the only thing I'll tell you is, just like it's not good to learn too little, it's not good to learn too much. And then he sent them off his way. So I'll paraphrase and say that these are the parameters. The big picture idea is the biggest. If I'm summing up, I really would like to take some questions. We have a few minutes. The big idea here is to create a framework where you have a real understanding of what that day is. As ear to the ground, knowing what's going on, when is my child going to go behind my back if I say no? And at that point, you start transitioning to the protect thing, where you become knowledgeable and you know what's going on, and you study stuff, and then, all the while, as they're using it, you think of, what am I going to do when she's 16 or 18 or 12, whatever you want to say, and I won't be able to supervise her. So we have to explain to them why it's not good. That's why I think the rulemaking is good. You're giving them a window into explaining why it's not good. And then, you know, this fascinating research on office rules, when workers have an input into the creating of office rules, they're 7 times more likely to follow it. That's where I got the idea from, by the way. I read it in a business magazine. I was just looking for ideas about something else, and that was the means if they have rules about who answers the phone or how rotations work. So if the brilliant boss sits up all night and makes a whole schedule and says, okay, here's what we're doing, it ain't getting done. But if he says, you know what, we have a problem, the phone's going on machine too often, could you figure out, one of the four of you figure out a plan, come back to me and I'll look it over. So it's 7 times more likely to be followed. Okay, one last thing, and then I'm going to take your questions. I would encourage you to make sure that you're congruent. Make sure that what you tell the kids, you live by. There is nothing more confusing to a child than going to a school that doesn't match what his parents are doing at all, or being in a house where the parents tell you things and they're not doing it themselves. Rav Schwab has a great vod on Manayach, might want to look it up. He asks about Shimshon's parents. Malach comes down, he tells him, you're going to have a kid, he should be a Nazir. And so Malach came to her. So the father says, hey, tell me, Hashem, what should I do? So he comes down and says, your kid's going to be a Nazir. Same thing. So Rav Schwab says, What did he not know? If you want to learn his ears, look it up in the Chumash. It's there. All the halachas are there. And why did he come a second time? He told him the same thing he said the first. He said, "Mikol Shamar Alisha Tishamer." Whatever I told your wife, that's what you should do. So Those of us who are married know that. You do whatever your wife says. Like, right? What do you have to tell them that? So Rav Schwab says, such a beautiful word. That wasn't his question, Rav Schwab says. His question is, how can I raise a nazir when I'm munching on grapes? That was his question. He said, Hashem, read the words there. Hashem should teach me how to do this. So the Malach came down and said, whatever I told your wife, you should do. You both should do. Stop eating grapes, because you're going to have a crazy kid. So it's really, and if you send your kids to a certain school and you don't agree with the policies, you got to, you know, get behind the school. It just doesn't work. I always say, you know, you could raise, my brother, my tzaddik brother, he's really, like, no technology at home. He raised Knei Nahara, 9 great kids, normal, very Hasidish, with it, all with the, you know, my brother has a flip phone, you know, from the Baba Surah. He doesn't have a 7, 12, whatever you got there, you know. He's got this old little flip phone, and he hardly goes, he goes on the internet for yeshiva, only in yeshiva. It's very congruent. His children, they daven in Emunas Yisrael. He sends the kids to Hasidic yeshivas. All 3 parts of that triangle have exactly the same message. It's very clear. And my children, we raised very differently. You know, we raised them with this approach. We sent them to yeshivas that more or less match that. And, you know, so they heard the same thing. I always say, you can't raise Yehuda's kids in Yankee's house. That's where it gets challenging. You can't try to raise Yehuda's kids, meaning ban everything from them, in Yankee's house. It doesn't work. Imagine if you sent your kids to healthy living classes. You wanted to be a vegan or a vegetarian, so you sent your kids to classes on how to become a vegetarian every Sunday or every Friday. And you said, listen, I'm paying a lot of money for this. You better make sure you learn all the vegetarian rules, okay? It's really important to me. Vegetarian stuff is very important. Just imagine, like, you come pick them up with, like, hot dog dripping with, you know, whatever, you know, cow ears and, you know, whatever. And you say, hey, so how was the class? Oh, it was very good. You learned about how processed food stinks. Oh, really? Interesting. Just think about it. Think about it. He said, I'm going to feher you on this over Shabbos. You better know it. Okay? Good. Great. Like, and go back next week. Like, and then when you say, hey, Dad, Ta, Abba, you're eating, then my teacher said, no, he didn't mean one of them. He meant that you shouldn't eat them breakfast, lunch, and supper. This is kind of okay. He didn't really mean that. He did mean it. So you gotta walk the walk, as they say. I'll take a few questions, please. You've been amazing. Thank you for listening. Yes?
What would you say to a teenager who wants to have a relationship with the opposite sex? They'll say that they want to be shomer negiah, they want to be shomer yichud.
How old? The question was, yes, the question was, what happens if a teenager tells you that he, you know, he, a boy, let's say, wants to be texting a girl or hanging out with somebody. So, you know, there are so many variables. It's a big problem because especially the texting or the phone capacity, the ability has made, again, the 8-hour house calls. It's very complicated. I certainly couldn't answer you like this. I mean, I think the approach really should be similar to technology. It's really like this with anything. That if the child is at a point where they're going to do it behind your back, you got to go to a really smart person and talk it through and really think. Because you don't want them doing this behind your back, because then there's no rule. Then there's nothing. Then there's no rules. But obviously you try to postpone. You try to protect. But it's complicated. I mean, I think the same philosophy applies, where you try to have some sort of understanding. You talk things over, and then you're in the game. But
the problem is when you make your list of what's wrong with it,
right?
Then he'll say, okay, no nigia.
Right.
So like you run out of things on the list, and he'll say, okay, I'm fine. So now what's wrong?
Right. So you might say that again, it depends how old the child is. It depends if they're in a place, in an environment. If the child is going, let's say, to a co-ed environment, or it's a friend of a sister's, and that, you know, they
don't.
What?
Dole
has a Dole
environment.
What's the... What?
The
what? So, you need a lot of wisdom. You need a lot of wisdom. It's really... you don't want them... You know, when kids... I always say this. When kids do stuff behind your back, they're not being parented. And it's really scary. So, sit down, think about it, talk about it. I certainly wouldn't say, okay, you have a discussion. Depends on the age, depends on so many variables. You know, if a kid's doing well in school and they have good self-esteem, it's easier for them to say no to something like that. If the children aren't doing well and she was a drag and they're not, you know, nothing is working in their life, and someone comes along and tells them that they're cute, that's really hard to, you know, to say. The rule is it's very hard to take away when you can't replace, right? So you can't replace that. So it's complicated. But I certainly wouldn't tell you to roll over and say do what you want. But and if you do, you really do put in some guidelines and you talk. You talk. That's what it's about. That's really what it's about. All of it. Yes, please. Anybody? Yes. They always, well, when I say prepare, I don't mean bring it in front of them and say, oh, here's stuff. Don't do this. You know what I mean? When was the last time do you ever touch a wall when you walk by? If there's a sign wet paint, you know, 10 out of 30 people are going to go to the, so when you say, you know, don't do this, it's human nature. So I'm not suggesting that, what I'm suggesting is that you start these conversations. It starts with the three things that I'm concerned about, and you have a conversation with them about it. Success doesn't mean that they're listening to you every time. Success means that you're talking about it and you're able to interact with them and help guide them. That's what success looks like. Not perfection. Hashem's perfect. But, and they're kids. They're impulsive. They're, it's very hard for them to, you know, when the kids tell you, when you say, what were you thinking? Right? That's a great parent one. You know, what were you thinking? I told you so. There's some lines that are like really good. This is really, you know, good. What are you thinking? They usually say, I wasn't. You say, what do you mean you weren't thinking? Yeah, here's another one. When you want to discuss with your children, this is a really great exercise. Try to do this, folks. Here's what you want to do. When you want to have a conversation with your child, see how long you can stick to that conversation, what you started talking about, and not get schlepped away to a different stage. I call it a side stage. Okay? It's really funny when you think, here's what it looks like, okay? My son Shlomi didn't clean up his room for Shabbos. I go up and talk to him about his room, right? I used to tell my boys that they have to clean up when they fall out of bed and they don't get hurt. Like if there's enough padding there that you don't get hurt, you got to clean up. Anyway, so I walk into the room to talk about, so again, focus. I'm glad you like that. Thank you. So I walk into the room to talk about cleanliness. That's all I had on my mind, right? How long can I stick to that topic? I used to do this as a Rebbe. I taught 8th grade Bays class for 15 years. And I started when I was 22 years old. I had 26 Talmidim the first year. I don't know how I survived. Anyway, so I used to always say, how long can I stick to my shiur before I get distracted? And if it is a disturbance, I used to really time myself. How fast can I get back to the shiur? You know something? If I'm a kid and a Rebbe goes bananas anytime there's an interruption, I keep making it through. It's great. You don't have to learn. You know, what are you doing? What's the matter with you? All the other kids are sitting there with their finger on the place. Like, why? I yell at him for 2 minutes. I call him the principal. So what I used to do is, this is the way it worked. I say, anyway, Yitzi, we need to talk later. And I try 2 seconds. I used to try to get back in 2 seconds. So he knows he's got to talk to me. I didn't discipline him in front of anybody. And I was able to get back in 2 seconds. Don't let the kids schlep you around. See, so here's what it looks like, guys. Okay? Think of it as a stage. This stage is about cleaning up the room. How long am I going to stay here? Most parents last about 5 seconds max. Okay, so here's what it sounds like in the real world. Shlomi, it's Erev Shabbos, you know, I let you go all week. You really need to clean up. How come it's, you know, what are you saying? How come, you know, Baruch, you didn't say anything to him because of, don't you dare raise your voice to me. How many times did I tell you? How long did I last? 2 seconds. Don't you dare. And you know why this is happening? Because of all those bad friends. I told you to stay away from him. But he's a nice kid and he's a, don't you raise me. Before you know it, you need a passport to get back. Okay? So, laugh, relax, enjoy. There's going to be a lot of ups and downs. Hashem gave us grandchildren as a reward for not strangling our teenagers. Okay? So just relax and learn to laugh. It's probably the best advice I can give you. We had 4 teenagers at the same time. My wife and I used to go for a walk for 20 minutes every single day during that time. First of all, to get out of the house. And we just, like, it was so stressful. You know, I was paying insurance on 4 cars. None of the kids ever put an ounce of gas in there. I used to put stickers on the windshield. E does not stand for excellent. So that's a humorous way of telling a kid, I'm going to bust your chops if you don't do it. And one of my sons learned how to, turn the corner and tore the tires. By the third one, they had to pay for it. I made him work until he paid for, So you have a balance of discipline. Try to make the punishment fit the crime, Taking away a phone because the kid doesn't make sense. It's the most effective thing, and it makes them crazy. But, and learn to laugh. Last story. So I had a deal with the kids that I had this power. When the kids became teenagers, I said, any jobs that I've been doing till now, because I was the only big person in the house, I'm going to stop doing. And I used to tell the kids, okay, I put in 15 years of doing this, now you unpack the car. That was the line. I put in my time. That's what I used to tell the kids. I put in my time, empty the car. I put in my time, please do this. So I'm sorry, guys, I don't want to get in trouble. I was doing the path for Matzah Shabbos. And I was up to my elbows, and my son was in, my oldest was in my study behind me, and he was walking by, and I was telling myself, the kid's 18 years old, why am I doing this path? He's a healthy kid, what's the matter with you? So I said, Baruch, I've been doing these paths for 18 years now. He says, boy, you must be really good at it. I could give him a musa shmooze, I could yell at him, that was a great line. So learn to laugh and enjoy and get with the program. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Good night.